sounded like genuine messages. Squadron Leader Parrish, please attend the ROC room. Or PBX calling Flying Officer MacPhail. Then some really scary ones. Severe fallout reported over Chipping Ongar. And 5-megaton bomb dropped over North London. They were accompanied by lots of crackly peep-peep-peeps, mysterious bleeps, and all was spoken in a period accent that sounded genuine to me, though I did think one of the voices sounded exactly like Peter Donaldson, the veteran BBC announcer, whom I used to meet in the days when I presented a BBC Radio 4 programme. I didn't know he was that old, or had been doing secret government work. It did turn out to be the Mr. Donaldson, but he had recorded the messages only recently, as a favour to Michael Parrish, the owner of the secret bunker. The reference to a squadron leader Parrish is one of his little jokes. I met Michael Parrish in the canteen, an avuncular-looking gentleman in his 60s. He must be worth a bob or two, as he farms 2,500 acres and lives in an ancient manor house on a site mentioned in the Doomsday Book with a lake created by Capability Brown. That day, however, while we were talking, he suddenly rushed off into the kitchen where he donned an apron and proceeded to get the lunch ready. The cook had not come, but Michael has always worked on the principle that if you want something done quickly, do it yourself. The Parrish family had been farming in Essex for at least 5 generations, growing wheat, rape and other stuff, when one day in 1952 a government official approached Michael's father and said they would like to buy 25 acres of his land. It was clear that if he didn't agree, a compulsory purchase order would be put in place, so he sold the 25 acres for the then market price of £100 an acre. Today, the average price in that part of Essex is between £4,000 and £5,000 per acre. When work started, digging into the hill, moving thousands of tons of soil, Michael says that of course local people could not help noticing, or being aware of the fleet of buses bringing in RAF personnel all day and night.
But we just accepted it. You have to remember that the war had not long finished, rationing was still going on. It was normal to see servicemen in uniform all over the place, strange constructions going up and government buildings with armed guards. No one questioned it. Today, of course, there would have been action groups demanding an explanation, holding protest meetings, wanting assurance there would be no pollution, the environment would be protected, bird life saved. In 1952, we were all pretty docile after a long, hard war. My grandfather had served in both wars and accepted what our government said. But my father, he was more inquisitive. He arranged with one of our farmhands who was doing some ploughing to send him a signal when the armed guards were on the other side of the hill. There were always one or two guarding the outer compound around the bunker. When the guards' backs were turned, my father ran up the hill and looked down into this massive hole, and could see hundreds of ant-like figures scurrying round, and lots of stairs and rooms. It clearly wasn't a reservoir, but all the same, he wasn't bothered. As a schoolboy, I would sometimes trespass on the site, just to see what was happening. Often an RAF guard would catch me and then call the police. Not exactly terrifying, as the police consisted of the village bobby who'd known me all my life. "Hello, Michael," he would say. Then he would have to go through the farce of asking me to produce documents proving my identity. Then he would let me off with a caution, telling me not to trespass again. The guards, who worked in shifts round the clock, were based in the bungalow at the entrance to the bunker, which, though it looks fragile and flimsy from the outside like a post-war prefab, was in fact bulletproof, with massive walls and steel ceilings. Officials and workers came and went all the time, going into the bunker to test equipment, check and repair, keeping everything in full working order, decade after decade. It was never fully occupied, but there were regular exercises lasting up to 2 weeks, when 60 or 100 people would lock themselves inside and live as if the bomb had gone off, broadcasting away, sending signals to other secret bunkers, which were also on manoeuvres. Sometimes there would be a mock attack on the bunker by the Territorial Army.
We also knew when a big exercise was going on.
wasn't just all the activity, we could smell them. Even with just 60 people living underground for 3 weeks, the pong would build up. When you passed the air vents, it would smell like rotten cabbage.
The original cost, in 1952, had been about 1.5 million. In the 60s, another 10 million was spent to make it suitable for the government team. In 1990, another 19 million had been earmarked for repairs and improvement, including any extra works. Even just keeping it empty but ready and waiting was costing 3 million a year. In 1992, the government finally decided it was all a nonsense, though naturally those words were not used. The Soviet Union had collapsed, the threat of nuclear attack from that source had therefore ceased, and it was announced they were decommissioning the Kelvedon Hatch bunker and all the others. Under the original agreement, when the initial purchase of the 25 acres had been made, they had to offer the land back to the Parrish family, still farming away, at the market price. They bought it, but all the structures underneath were not included. That was being put out to tender, a secret tender.
"We were determined, as the family farming all the land, that we could not let it go to someone else who would perhaps allow the public in to trample over our fields and paths. We had to control it."
They bid as much for the bunker as they thought it would go for. He says now he can't remember how much they had to pay, but it was a lot for the time. They later heard that other bidders had included people who wanted to use it as a warehouse, for electronic testing, to turn into a pistol range and, perhaps scariest of all, at least three religious organisations who were interested in using it for their own purposes as a retreat.
"We honestly didn't know what we were going to do with it when we first bought it, but there was such a great deal of media interest and public attention that we decided to open it up for a week and let people visit. Loads and loads came to it. We did it again another weekend and thought, this is great. Why don't we charge people for conducted tours?"
So that was what they did, with Michael blithely taking round groups of 20 at a time, giving them a personal tour and commentary, though at the time he knew very little about the purpose or contents of the bunker. Almost immediately, being only a simple farmer, as he still likes to call himself, he fell foul of every possible health and safety law, building control, fire regulations. The endless bureaucracy almost made him wish he had never started, but he was determined to succeed, despite having to close for 6 months while awaiting the results of various applications. He had one long row with the council, who would not let them use the existing country lane, and made them form a new private mile-long road to the bunker, built at their own expense. The biggest and most expensive alteration they had to make was when the fire brigade ordered them to install a new exit, for safety reasons in the event of an emergency. They therefore had to knock through the 10-feet-thick concrete walls. It took 11 weeks, using diamond cutters, just to create a hole. They got their initial planning consents in stages, 6 months at a time, and it was 7 years before they had all the full planning agreements. But from 1994, they began opening to the public. Michael quickly tired of the idea of guided tours, as he personally found it exhausting, while still trying to run the farm and wrestle with all the planning problems. So to save money and labour, he hit on the idea of letting the public enter on their own, without any charge, until they reached the end. There would be no tickets, entry barriers, or human contact.
"We farmers are very practical people. When I worked out that we needed to pay someone £60 a day to sit at the entrance to the tunnel and sell tickets, I realised it was a waste of money."
It does, of course, he now realises, create a perfect atmosphere of mystery and suspense, as it does feel as if you were really entering a secret bunker. In the early days, they provided little tape machines and earpieces, but they were not very efficient or handy. Then, around 10 years ago, when he heard the Millennium Dome was going bust and selling off their state-of-the-art technology, he bought 300 of their wands, the very latest in audio guidance, which is what they use today. But
Aha, the bunker is not exactly free. At the very end of the tour, which on average takes between 2 and 4 hours, you hand in your wand at the canteen and are then encouraged to put £6.50 per adult, or £4.50 for children, into an honesty box. It just lies there on a little table, a scruffy wooden box, unsupervised, totally dependent on people being honest and coughing up. As you go round, there is another little honesty box in which you are supposed to put £2 if you want to take photographs. In the box, I noticed, there were 3 £1 coins, with a little handwritten scrawl saying, "This will be your change if you pay with a £5 note. The day I was there, a party of Americans were busy taking photos of the honesty box, unable to believe such a system could work. Surely it gets abused. In the early days, we did get a few Essex-wide boys who heard about the open honesty box, and they did come in and nick quite a bit. But that doesn't seem to happen anymore. We don't know exactly what percentage of people are honest and pay up, but I believe the vast majority do. We even have an honesty box for soft drinks where people help themselves, and that seems to work okay as well. The fact that we now have proper surveillance cameras, for safety's sake really, and to help people who are lost, probably encourages people to be more honest than they might otherwise be. I like to think most people are fair and honest, but from our point of view the object is still the same, to save us money and manpower, so we can devote ourselves to more important things. The second most important thing, after getting all the planning permissions, was stocking the bunker. When they finally took it over, they found the government had cleared out almost all the contents, selling some stuff but dumping most of it as scrap. I don't know why they did this. When I heard, I tried to stop them, but we hadn't at that time legally taken everything over, so we could do nothing about it. Fortunately, he realized that the government was doing the same thing with all the bunkers all over the country, so he rushed round and made clearance deals, either with the government or with the new owners. There were quite a few legal firms who bought some of the smaller bunkers, and they wanted all the old contents cleared at once, so they could store their own documents. In most cases, we got the stuff for free. We also got given a lot of artifacts, equipment, historical documents when people heard what we were doing, and we eventually managed to track down a lot of stuff which had been here in this bunker. Being a farmer helped as well, as he always had lorries and tractors and trailers and strong men at his disposal, able to rush off and collect stuff at a moment's notice. He also managed to contact many of the RAF guards and government officials who had worked in the bunker over the 40 years or so when it was still operational. They had signed the Official Secrets Act, so in theory could not spill the beans. He invited about 100 of them to lunch, and asked them to write down their personal memories. Almost all of them, on first returning, exclaimed about the smell. They said the polish on the floor was exactly as they had remembered it, yet they had never smelled that same smell since. This is because it is exactly the same polish, special government issue, which Michael managed to track down. He has a huge supply of it, which will last many decades ahead, as vast supplies were left in the bunker. One of the ex-Home Office guards was hired for a while to go with them on their tours of other bunkers, advising them on what stuff to buy. He didn't reveal any information because of the Secrets Act, but when asked if this would be a good item for us, he would nod or shake his head. No professional historians were employed, or expert designers or graphic artists to help them recreate the bunker as it was. They worked things out as they went along, researching items and notices as they acquired them. Today, they have about 60,000 visitors a year, a figure that goes up gradually most years. Michael's son James, having read agriculture at Reading University, is now mainly responsible for the farm, while Michael is still occupied with the bunker. I still do 7 days a week in the summer months anyway. As a farmer, that is how you are brought up. Some 10 years ago, when he was still trying to put the bunker on the map, he announced that for £30,000, anyone could be guaranteed to use the bunker for up to 10 years in the event of a nuclear bomb or attack.
It got a lot of coverage, but nobody actually took up the offer. I just did it for publicity anyway. But after 9/11, the threat of some attack became much more real, and I suddenly got about 200 inquiries. Nothing came of any of them, but people had got worried again, as in the Cold War. I then found myself receiving death threats, accused of trying to cash in on a tragedy like 9/11. I hadn't, of course, as the offer had been made long before 9/11. I'd really forgotten all about it, but some paper had dug out the old story. I discovered later that the people making the death threats were firemen. He now does corporate events, hires out some of the rooms for conferences, which I found hard to believe. Who would want their fun day out to be in an underground bunker? But that day, there was a party of 20 NHS workers having a private lunch, a tour of the bunker, and a bit of paintballing, one of the new activities he has set up in his woods. He says, yes, the bunker does make a bit of money, but can't offhand give figures. Better than farming?
You can't compare the two. Obviously, the farm, as its 2,500 acres, makes more money in a year, but in farming you only have one big cash day. With the bunker, I have a cash flow every day.
He has still not taken a penny in grants or funding to open or run the bunker, even though they are now one of the main attractions of the local tourist economy in Essex.
We have once and only once received some public money. It was during Foot and Mouth. They gave us £3,000 as compensation for loss of income when school parties were not allowed on visits. Other than that, we have never received nor applied for any grants or financial help. I prefer to be in control of our own destiny and not be beholden to others. We are not a trust, because with a trust you will have trustees, some of whom will think they know what's best. We are not even a company. I refuse to hide anything behind a company name. We are still just a farming family, doing things our way, on our own.
He has a daughter as well as a son, and 4 grandchildren, and he hopes one day perhaps they will take over the running of the bunker. But whatever happens, he wants it to stay in the family forever.
I see it in many ways as like owning an ancient castle, the sort of building many landed families have inherited and have had to look after over the centuries. Castles were originally defensive, to protect against enemies. This bunker is a modern version, only it happens to have been built underground. But I still feel the same pride in ownership, of owning an historic monument, caring for it, working out ways of making it pay its way. Like an upside-down Norman castle, it was built to last.
But, as a Briton, is he proud of it? Did our dear government do a good job in creating this and all the other hundreds of bunkers?
All governments are cynical. If you look at the instructions on that ancient copy of Protect and Survive, it is clear they wanted you to stay in your house, knowing you would probably perish. And afterwards, they would know where you were. They weren't actually interested in you personally or your greater good. What they didn't want was you out in the street and rioting. On the other hand, it had to be done. They couldn't have lawless gangs roaming around. Where I do take real exception to what the government did is that they wasted so much money. They were forever starting new policies and systems at vast expense when the existing ones were perfectly okay. That old Protect and Survive leaflet, which they printed in millions, was redone again quite recently, yet basically the advice was the same as it had been 40 years earlier. They did this all the time, bureaucracy gone mad, changing things every 3 months, keeping themselves occupied and important, throwing our money around. I assume today they have a modern version of these bunkers, in fact I know they have, where the Prime Minister and his main officials will retreat to, if and when there is a massive terrorist attack, ready in case the suicide bombers land in Whitehall and planes start crashing into Downing Street. Governments have always operated by fear. Our fear that something awful is about to happen, whether it is a nuclear bomb, terrorism, or global warming. They need us to be frightened, so we will pay our taxes, but of course, they take it to extremes. I mean, they are still making every airline passenger take off their shoes when they enter any airport. That's ridiculous. Bureaucracy gone mad. But they need us to feel fear. To believe they are doing things for our good, even when the risks are totally minuscule.
Would he rush into his own bunker if he thought a terrorist attack was on its way, heading straight for Essex?
Oh, I'd be very stupid not to, wouldn't I? If I didn't take advantage of my very own nuclear bunker, I'd never forgive myself. So yes, I always do make sure there is fresh water in the bunker and lots of dried fruit we could live on.
Who is we?
My own family, of course. We own it. Naturally, there would have to be a list of those who qualified as family. Would I, for example, invite my granddaughter's current boyfriend into the bunker? And if so, would we also invite his parents? I often lie awake thinking of it, amusing myself, working it out, for it changes all the time. But it could be done when the time came. After all, it would be no harder than working out a wedding list. They can, of course, cause problems, and people missed out get upset. This time it could well be a matter of life and death for those not on the list.
I also found myself lying awake at night, for days after I had visited the secret bunker. It is so unusual, in fact unique, that there are not really any lessons to be learned for a would-be museum creator. It is totally a one-off. The bunker came first, was already there. The museum had to be created round it. Not the sort of place that a diploma or a degree or a master's in modern museum studies prepares you for. Entering without having to pay, or without the need for any staff at the entrance, that is an idea I could pinch. But would it work with an ordinary building, and create the same sort of atmosphere? It really was the most extraordinary museum that I had visited so far. I kept on dreaming I was trapped inside, wandering round the 40 rooms, lost and locked in forever, the only human left alive on the planet. It was so strange, eerie, scary, and yet I found myself raving about it, telling everyone that they must go and see it. If you're ever anywhere near that part of Essex, don't miss it. It's amazing. Perhaps bizarre is a better word. It was bizarre to build it in the first place, at a time when the world was pretty bizarre, and then equally bizarre to think of turning into a museum of our times. The Kelvedon Hatch Secret Nuclear Bunker, Crown Buildings, Kelvedon Hall Lane, Kelvedon Hatch, Essex, CM14 5TL. Telephone 01277-364-883. www.secretnuclearbunker.com. Chapter 17. The Old Operating Theatre, London Bridge. Having gone underground, time to go up in the world. Setting off to find my highest museum meant, alas, going on the tube, now that I was back in horrible, marvellous old London town. By going on the tube, I was breaking all my rules, which I have stuck to for 10 years. My only ambition in life, I used to tell myself, was never to go on the tube again. Modest enough and easily achievable. But looking at the map, seeing that this museum was right next to London Bridge, which is on the Northern Line, direct from Kentish Town, my local station, and reading that morning's newspaper which announced a series of marches and demonstrations in central London to do with the G20 meetings and President Obama's first visit to London, I decided that going by tube would be easiest and quickest. The smell was the same. Nasty. The atmosphere spooky and oppressive. The people looked unhuman and unpresent, refusing to admit the presence of other unhumans. At least, on London buses, people do sometimes speak to each other. The biggest change in 10 years was nothing. The platform clock, the carriages, the upholstery of the seats had not only remained the same, they seemed to have gone backwards in time. So the experience of being on the Northern Line had somehow taken on a period charm. Quite a neat way, I thought, of coming towards the end of a book about museums,
using a form of transport that is itself a museum piece. I got out at London Bridge Station and was immediately lost. I used to go regularly to this station on Saturdays about 20 years ago, in the days when the whole forecourt was taken over by a massive, if shambolic, collector's fair, searching for treasures for my various collections. It was one of the cheapest such markets in London. The nearest to it now, on a Saturday, is underneath the arches at Charing Cross Station. It's mainly stamps and coins, but beautifully scruffy and atmospheric. Covent Garden on a Monday is quite good, while Spitalfields on a Thursday can be excellent. It's a confusing station, anyway, as it's built on several levels. I walked round the block a few times, unable to work out which direction I was facing or even where the Thames might be, which seems daft, as I knew it must be only yards away. I do have a poor sense of direction. In strange hotels, it takes me several nights to remember where the lavatory is, unless I leave chalk marks on the ground. I found myself back at the station forecourt, and so asked a taxi driver which was St. Thomas Street. On the map it appeared right beside the station and seemed a major road, but it turned out to be more of a side street, a little Georgian enclave, so quiet and sedate, so hidden away. The address I was looking for was number 9A St. Thomas Street, which told me nothing, gave me few clues. The full title of the museum, now I looked at my notes again, was The Old Operating Theatre Museum and Herb Garret. Very confusing. I had worked out that the theatre bit was medical, not theatrical, but who was Herb Garret? A famous surgeon, perhaps, from the 19th century? Would I see a mock-up of his gory operations with fake blood and plastic limbs all over the place? Not the sort of exhibit I would normally want to see, being of a squeamish disposition. But I know there are those who do find operations interesting. Such as Noel Coward. In 1969, to celebrate his 70th birthday, Coward agreed to give one interview, which was to the Sunday Times, where I was chief feature writer. He invited me to dinner at his house in Switzerland. I booked into a local hotel, the Montreux Palace Hotel, and awaited his call. When it came, it was to cancel. The master is indisposed, so I was informed by his secretary, Cole Leslie. Born Leslie Cole, but Coward had changed it. However, I could join the master the next evening. It meant I had 24 hours to put in, with nothing to do. Hanging around an empty reception area next morning, my eye caught a directory of names and room numbers. The hotel appeared totally empty as it was out of season, but I realized there was a wing containing permanent residents. I read the names upside down and saw that one was called Nabokov. Could it be Vladimir? I went back to my room, rang his number, and talked him into seeing me. We met at a coffee bar in the town, and he chatted away for over an hour, but on one condition. I wasn't to write anything about our conversation. Next night, I reported to Coward's house, where I enjoyed an excellent dinner during which Coward performed, telling lots of funny stories, mostly of a theatrical nature. Many I'd heard before, or read in the cuttings, so to get him off the subject, I asked him what sort of things he did locally, at home in Switzerland. He said, well, the previous week he'd been to watch an operation. I tried not to express too much surprise, asking if he did this regularly. Oh, yes, he had friends who were surgeons in many cities, and they often let him observe them at work. He'd seen hysterectomies, childbirth, death. By now I could hardly contain my amazement, perhaps appearing too fascinated by what he was telling me, wanting to know precisely what pleasure he got out of it. He suddenly changed the subject, refused to discuss it any further. I've often wondered since what it revealed about his true character, and why people who are not medics would want to witness other humans being cut up. I suppose remembering that incident was one reason I was here, wanting to see a real operating theatre for myself. But not in use, of course. Or so I presumed. Number 9A is a small, modest doorway leading into a small entrance hall. Ahead there was a glass door leading into what appeared to have been a church, but was now some sort of classy offices. To the side, an arrow pointed to the old Operating Theatre Museum. It led upstairs via a narrow and winding stone spiral staircase, which I started to ascend, squeezing myself up. I'm quite thin, if not quite as thin as I was, but a person of hefty proportions, which of course 2/3 of the British population are these days, could easily find these narrow, bendy stairs hard to negotiate. Some people must get stuck, jammed on the staircase. I went up and up, and eventually came to a wooden door barring my way. There was nothing on it except the words, "Open this door." I felt I'd stumbled into an upside-down Alice in Wonderland world. Instead of falling down through a hole in the ground, I feared I'd fallen up into the air. How could it possibly lead to a hospital operating theatre? Obviously it wasn't in operation today, or I would have seen the ambulances and stretchers and bodies. That would have been a clue. But even in ye olden days, when it was a working operating theatre, how and why did they have it in such a high, awkward place? All the way up these narrow stone spiral steps which led, well, wherever they might lead. I opened the door, and it was a wonderland, one of the most remarkable little museums I'd ever seen. But it did take me some time to work it all out, and discover how and why it came to be here. The site was once St. Thomas's Hospital, hence the name of the street outside. Originally, in the 12th century, it was part of a priory, the monks and nuns doing the nursing, such as it was, but mainly offering hospitality, from which the term hospital comes, to poor and sick travellers, many of them pilgrims on their way to Canterbury. In 1215, after a fire, the hospital was rebuilt, and it continued to operate as a hospital for the next 650 years. It was a charitable hospital for poor people, catering for all ages, including children, who were lumped in with the older patients. But from the beginning, there were always separate male and female wards. During the 1720s, another hospital was built alongside St. Thomas's, catering for the incurables, those patients St. Thomas's refused to admit. It was funded by a wealthy city printer and publisher called Sir Thomas Guy. He had made a killing on the stock market during the South Sea bubble and donated some of his winnings towards a new hospital. It was named after him, Guy's Hospital. Thus, we have two of London's most famous hospitals sitting there side by side for the next 150 years. St. Thomas's Church was part of St. Thomas's Hospital, originally the hospital's chapel. But the present building went up in 1703, in the style of Sir Christopher Wren, who was a governor of the hospital, though the architect was Thomas Cartwright, Wren's master mason. It seems to have operated both as a proper church, open to all, and a hospital chapel. In 1859, Florence Nightingale became involved with St. Thomas's, hoping to establish a nursing school as part of the hospital. After her return from the Crimea in 1856, she had been working on the Nightingale Fund, raising money to create the first proper training school for nurses. Nursing had traditionally been a low-grade occupation, on a level with domestic service, and nurses were not trained but just picked up skills while working on the job. Surgeons and physicians and male assistant dressers, who assisted surgeons during operations, were considered quite sufficient, and the medical profession resisted any moves to create another layer of medics who might well challenge their power and positions. Florence Nightingale managed to get the money together, some £50,000, and her famous nursing school opened at St. Thomas's in June 1860 with 15 pupils. And then it moved out again 2 years later. One of the reasons she was keen to move into St. Thomas's was that she knew its days were numbered. The whole hospital was likely to have to move to a new site, and she therefore reckoned that by moving with them, she would end up with brand new premises, as opposed to the sprawling, decaying collection of ancient buildings that St. Thomas's had become. All the old hospital buildings soon disappeared, knocked down and rebuilt as part of the railway premises or as a new post office, all except the Church of St. Thomas. That is the only part remaining today of what was originally the medieval hospital. So how come the old operating theatre exists today, if the hospital itself disappeared? Ah, the answer to that is that the theatre, when it was rebuilt in 1822, had been built into the roof of the church itself, under the rafters. The reason for building it there was that it backed onto the female ward, which was at the top of the hospital building next door. They were, therefore, able to knock through and give easy access from the female ward right into the operating theatre. The other advantage was that by being in the roof of the church, they could give themselves lots of excellent natural light by installing fanlights in the roof. I think I've got all that correct, more or less. Anyway, the upshot was that when the whole hospital was moved, the old operating theatre part was left stranded, still in the roof, but of no more use or interest. It was blocked off, ignored, and pretty much forgotten for the next 100 years. Of interest to nobody, except, of course, anyone who happened to be a medical historian, especially one researching the history of Guy's and St. Thomas's hospitals. A gentleman called Raymond Russell, after some research, discovered, or at least rediscovered, the theatre in 1956. A restoration campaign was set up with, as its figurehead, Lord Brock of Wimbledon. Russell Claude Brock, later Lord Brock of Wimbledon, had been a student at Guy's and went on to become one of the pioneers of cardiac surgery and president of the Royal College of Surgeons. He was known as being pretty fierce and a stickler for correct medical usage. A woman patient once asked him, "Do I need surgery, sir?" And he replied, "Everyone needs surgery, madam. What you need is an operation." This story is still told in medical circles, but personally I can't see why he corrected her. He must have known what the woman meant. Brock was also a keen medical historian and writer, and in his retirement spent a lot of time researching the history of medicine. In the 1950s, along with several others, he started looking into the history of Guy's and St. Thomas's. In 1956, it was decided to make a proper investigation of the old operating theatre. Someone climbed up into the rafters to see what, if anything, was still there. It was discovered that most of the shell was intact, including the original plasterwork walls and the greater part of the floor. By clever detective work, examining the different ways the wood had discoloured, it was possible to work out where the original steps and cupboards of the theatre had been. They were also able to locate an old inventory of the theatre that had been made in 1862, before the contents had been dispersed and the attic closed. Lord Brock led a campaign to raise interest and funds, and with the help of a grant from the Wolfson Foundation, they opened the attic to the public in 1962. Since then, they have collected hundreds of ancient medical instruments and artifacts, turning the whole attic into a medical museum. The first thing that strikes you is, yes, this really is still a church attic. The beams and rafters are enormous, looming over your head, leading into every corner. In fact, the building is itself a museum, quite apart from its contents and the part it played in medical history. So many museums often have to make do with a rough conversion, taking over premises meant for other purposes. The second impression is that it's just the sort of museum I like. Full of real objects, not audio stuff and computer visuals, and all of it in apparent clutter and chaos, with exhibits and cases and displays scattered everywhere, on ledges and shelves and tables, nooks and crannies. On closer inspection, though, you can soon see that all of it has been beautifully and carefully arranged, with excellent labels and explanations, neatly and artistically written by the curator, Karen Howell. The third impression, which hits you in the nose the minute you have finally scaled the heights, is the delicious, herby, pungent smell. This attic, as well as containing the female operating theatre, was also the hospital's storage room for its medical herbs and natural potions, hence the word herb in its title. I didn't know where to start, which usually annoys curators in modern professionally designed museums. They have bossily organised it in a certain way, with lots of arrows and numbers and plans, forcing you to proceed in a certain order. Or so they hope. It always confuses me, and I find myself going in the wrong direction. Sometimes, deliberately, in order not to trail round with the herd. In this case it didn't matter. The cases and displays didn't appear to be laid out in any order. You were just left to wander round, gaping. My eyes alighted first on some leech jars, big old glass jars in which leeches were kept. I could see scratches inside the glass where perhaps the leeches tried to get out, or maybe the marks were made by the instruments used to take them from the jars. You clearly didn't want to take them out with your bare hands, as leeches, so a note informed me, have three jaws and hundreds of tiny sharp teeth. If you got bitten by one, the wound would be trifoliate, with three sides. You could bleed for up to 12 hours, which of course was the point. The theory of bloodletting was that it drained away the bad humours in a sick person. On the other hand, you could give them snail water to make them better. Ordinary garden snails were soaked in water for 24 hours, the liquid mixed with herbs, such as juniper berries, aniseed and cloves, then the patient drank it. Said to be good as a treatment for venereal diseases, according to a pharmacy book dated 1718. The nursing equipment included a fiendish-looking stomach pump, a metal nipple shield, and a female and a male urine bottle from the 1800s, each made of pewter. They looked like large hip flasks. The female version had a larger, flared spout, while the male spout was smaller. In a case marked obstetrics, there were some forceps from the 18th century which looked pretty much as they are today in shape, if a little heavier. Perhaps the eeriest displays were the human specimens, parts of long-gone bodies preserved in ancient jars of formaldehyde, including a section of a child's brain, a heart cut in half, a kidney, and a uterus. I wondered why Damien Hirst hadn't thought of trying to use humans instead of animal bodies. Much more dramatic. The so-called herb garret was in one corner under the eaves, but of course its fragrances were everywhere. It looked like a rather high-class farmer's market, with all the herbs laid out in ever-so-sweet straw baskets. The earliest reference to this area of the church attic being used as a herb store for the hospital dates from 1821, but it is assumed it was in use much earlier. It is clearly a good, dry, safe place with plenty of air, where the herbs were cured, dried, and then made into medical compounds for use on the hospital patients. When the attic was opened up in 1956, dried opium poppy heads were found amongst cracks in the rafters. The hospital itself would have had its own herb garden outside for growing the herbs, but were also have bought supplies from herb women who travelled round hospitals and clinics with their baskets. Until the development of the chemical and pharmaceutical industries in the late 19th century, virtually all medicinal compounds were made out of natural plants. Today, it is estimated that 70% of our medicines still originate from plant sources. There is a record, dated 1605, of a woman in the female ward at St. Thomas's having a bath that contained herbs and a sheep's head. I'm sure Prince Charles would have approved of that. I could see other visitors sniffing the herbs, like Bisto kids, breathing in and out and exclaiming, while some of the cheekier ones were picking up handfuls, running them through their fingers, lifting them up and smelling them. In most ordinary museums, of course, you are not allowed to touch or handle any of the objects. There seemed to be no notice on the herb basket saying, "Don't touch," so I did the same. The herbs included many I had never seen before in the flesh, such as marshmallow, which is not the soft sweet loved by children, but a form of twig that grows in marshes. It was used to aid digestion. There were baskets of frankincense and myrrh, which I never even knew were herbs. There were bits of willow bark, from which I learned an early forerunner of aspirin was extracted and used to cure pains and headaches. The bark contains salicin, from which aspirin was later synthesized. I had heard of comfrey, which I'd come across in lots of 19th-century letters, but never knew that it was a herb. It was renowned for its healing power. The old operating theatre itself is entered from a corner, and then up some more stairs, so you look down into it. It reminded me of Mitchell's auction ring in Cockermouth, where cattle have for centuries been auctioned. It is circular in shape, like a small amphitheatre with tiers of wooden steps and railings where spectators could watch, looking down into the centre where the beast for sale would be paraded, or, in this case, some poor woman was going to be operated on. The actual operating table made of wood did look like a butcher's block. You can see why it was called a theatre. The setting was theatrical, the construction very like a real theatre, the audience looking down onto the stage, all eyes focused on the drama before them. This theatre ceased to be in operation after 1860 when the hospital moved, and it did not use anaesthetics until its last few years. Reliable anaesthetics did not come in till 1846, when experiments with chloroform began, and St. Thomas's itself did not have its first anaesthetist on the staff till 1878. As for antiseptic procedures, they came in long after this operating theatre had closed, thanks to the work of Sir Joseph Lister, published in 1867. So, for almost all its history, this operating theatre was a bit like a butcher's, with limbs chopped off, parts of bodies removed, without the poor patient having any recourse to any sort of painkiller. Below the operating table, the floor was covered in sawdust to soak up the blood and gore. The patient was usually blindfolded, led into the theatre from the adjoining ward, not quite knowing what was going to happen or where she was, or aware that so many people were now staring at her. It then all depended on the speed of the surgeon, a cool head, the sharpness of his tools, and his knowledge of anatomy to extract the offending organ in the quickest time, with the least pain. And yet, for centuries, surgeons did manage successfully to do amputations, the removal of bladder stones and trepanation, operations on the skull, with quite a lot of the patients living to tell the tale. There was, of course, a high risk of infection, as the causes of it were not then properly realized. Surgeons usually operated in their frock coats, stiff and stinking with pus and blood. If they did wash their hands, it was usually after, rather than before an operation. St. Thomas's, along with Guy's next door, became an important teaching hospital from the 18th century onwards, and the operating theatre provided an opportunity for students to watch their masters at work. There is a graphic description of an operation at St. Thomas's, which was written by a medical student in 1814. "The first few rows were occupied by other dressers, and behind a second partition stood the pupils, packed like herrings in a barrel. Those behind were continually pressing on those before, and not infrequently had to be got out exhausted. There was also a continual calling out of "heads, heads" to those about the table whose heads interfered with the sightseers. After our operations were over, the students rushed down two flights of stairs and across the street to Guy's to rush up as many stairs and repeat the same scrabbling for places as before. The importance of the operation, and the reputation of the operator, had a large influence on the number of spectators and their violent scrambling to gain entrance. It often led to severe contests and even fighting with the hospital servants. That day, I was alone in the theatre, but it was easy to imagine the atmosphere when a star surgeon was at work. Beside his operating table were cupboards filled with his tools for amputations. I could see a strange-looking machine like a mangle, which apparently was a bandage winder for quickly bandaging up people who were bleeding heavily after their op. I couldn't think of a comparable instrument today, although for many of the old tools on display there are modern equivalents. The museum has at its entrance a set of 1821 theatre regulations painted on a wall, which were applied in the theatre in its operating days.
Apprentices and dressers of the surgeon who operates are to stand round the table. The dressers of the other surgeons are to occupy the three front rows. The surgeon's pupils are to take their places in the rows above. Visitors are admitted by permission of the surgeon who operates.
So, even in the old days, visitors were allowed to watch. I wondered if they would have been the Noel Cowards of their day, celeb actors and impresarios or rich city merchants. I then noticed one of the museum staff, who had come to replace a light bulb in one of the display cabinets that had been flickering off and on. She said she was, in fact, the assistant curator, Kirsty Chilton, and she also gave medical lectures. In a hospital, I asked? No, here in the theatre, she explained. Most Saturdays there is a lecture in the theatre at 2 o'clock, in which she describes what the procedure used to be like. I asked her which of the many exhibits she personally liked best, and she took me to a large case filled with knives. I'd hardly looked at them as they looked like, well, knives, if very big and frightening ones. Surgeons must have been pretty big and strong to use them properly. She pointed out the ones that were used for trepanation, for opening up the brain. I said I'd been particularly struck by the human specimens in the bottles, wondering if Damien Hirst might use them. No chance, she said. We now have to get a license for them. A Human Tissue Act has come in which prohibits the display of human body parts without permission. I think about the only other place in London you will see them is the Royal College of Surgeons. She was clearly very proud of their museum, especially the operating theatre, and said it was the only old operating theatre in the world that can be seen in situ. Padua and Leiden do have theatres that can be seen, but they were dissecting theatres, not operating ones. Most old operating theatres were brought up to date, converted and altered over the years. But because this closed in 1862, it was never modernised. I told her my Noel Coward story, and asked if she imagined that celebs in the old days were allowed in. She looked quite aghast at the very idea. I suppose it might have been done, but I've never seen it listed. I've always assumed that by visitors it meant VIP visitors connected with the hospital, like one of the governors, not total outsiders. The museum has a total staff of 6, director, curator, and 4 assistants, who all muck in, helping to keep the place clean and tidy, as well as working on the research and educational side. They're always on the lookout for medical equipment and items they might not have, as long as they are of the right period. Yes, it was true. They didn't mind people picking up the herbs and smelling them, as people enjoyed it. And very few of the herbs get stolen. But every year or so they have to renew them when the scents fade, just as they had to in the old days. It was so pleasant to find a museum with a nice smell. I'd heard lots of interesting sounds and noises on my travels, from the Northumbrian pipes to scratchy soundtracks from old Laurel and Hardy films, but had not done a lot of smelling. I suppose there must be museums somewhere that are all smells, for I've heard of museums in Europe that are devoted to perfume. I wonder why more museums don't feature interesting smells, perhaps a different aroma for every room, instead of being obsessed by computer things for the kiddies. I wondered if in my museum I could drag in and incorporate some smells. Such a useful and unusual addition to any museum, and an attraction in its own right. My collection of old football programmes do have their own, particular aroma, which I personally find so resonant and romantic. But I have to admit that most people go, "Ugh, what's that damp smell?" It was also pleasant to visit such a personal, human-cluttered, ad hoc sort of museum. Not the type of presentation I had expected from something so scientific. I'd considered several medical-related museums, as there are quite a few around the country, but they all sound institutional, dry and ascetic, as opposed to fun. It had been such fun that I went round all the objects and displays again in case I'd missed anything. Not hard to do, for as museums go it is pretty small, but awfully crowded. As I was leaving, the girl on the counter at the little shop, an Italian called Valentina Lari, asked me if I'd seen any signs of a ghost. "We are supposed to have the ghost of Florence Nightingale. I've not seen her myself, nor has any of the staff, but we have members of supernatural societies who come here looking for her and swear to her existence. They often hold their meetings here just to get close to her ghost. Some of them are clubs who stay the night here, soak up the atmosphere, measure their own temperatures to see if there are ghosts around." I later talked to the museum's director, Kevin Flood. He is an archaeologist by training, who used to lead walks round London and give lectures. In 1989, he found the museum had closed, for no apparent reason, and remained closed for some time. "I made inquiries and found that the old curator had left and they couldn't find anyone to run it. So, a partner and I offered to take it over. We've been running it ever since. I think we're probably the only museum in London that is virtually self-supporting. We get between 25 and 30,000 visitors a year and rely on them for our income. We are a charity, of course, but we are not part of a bigger body or supported by a professional organisation like most medical museums, so we don't get any funding apart from the odd grant of 1,000 or 2. Naturally, we'd like more if we could, but at the moment we are surviving, even in these hard times. We have had clever young designers coming in and offering us plans to revamp and redesign it and make our displays more modern and edgy, but I have one basic rule. Don't fuck it up, stupid. I am resisting all attempts at updating, but there is a chance I might agree in the near future to include a small audio-visual display. Kevin, don't do it. The Old Operating Theatre Museum and Herb Garret, 9A St. Thomas Street, London SE1 9RY. Telephone 0207 188 2679. www.thegarret.org.uk. Chapter 18. The Packaging Museum, Notting Hill. For 20 years, watching and wondering from afar, I have intended to visit the Museum of Brands, Packaging and Advertising, to give it its present, rather formal and off-putting mouthful of a title. It is basically just a load of old packets, boxes and tins, or so it seemed when I first saw a feature on it in the Sunday Times colour supplement many years ago. The colours, the images, the graphics, the memories conjured up were so striking that I remember thinking, how utterly brilliant. Wish I'd thought of that. It seemed to be the ultimate in collecting, landing upon a subject that no one seemed to have thought of before, doing it so marvellously, then creating your own museum on your own chosen topic. Ah, bliss. So why didn't I go and visit it, if I considered it so unusual? Not sure. Mainly because it was in Gloucester, and life and work and circumstances never took me anywhere near Gloucester. When I was in Bath earlier on postal duty, and then heading for Baked Beans in Wales, I did think this would be the chance, the perfect occasion, to visit and properly investigate the Packaging Museum. Now I was in the West Country, more or less, only to find that it was no longer in Gloucester, had not been for some time. Behind my back, it had migrated to London and was on my doorstep, more or less. Instead, I've been able to save it up for my final destination once I was back in London after my round tour, and a chance, at long last, to meet Robert Opie, who had long been my hero from afar, and find out how it all began. Cue music, bit of crunching, paper